All right, we will now call the second case on our docket this morning, Linda Faust and Donnie Faust versus BNSF Railway Company. Mr. Woodfill, you may proceed.
May I please the court? Good morning, Justice McCoy, Justice Walker, Justice Meyer. This case comes from the 96th Judicial District Court. It is a brief summation of the facts. It's a toxic tort case involving a tie plant. A tie plant is just a piece of wood that is used as a foundation for a rail. And what you do prior to actually putting the piece of wood, the tie, out on the rail, you treat it. You treat it with a chemical known as creosote. This involves a facility in Somerville, Texas, where that process took place for about 100 years. And we're talking about injuries resulting in my client as a result of dioxins and PAHs being emitted from the facility. And to go back to what happened at the trial, Your Honors, and the first point that we are complaining about, as the court is well aware, under Rule 702, the trial judge has or serves as a gatekeeper for all scientific evidence that comes in at trial. There's a series of cases, beginning with Daubert, Robinson, and then Havner, where the court exercises its ability as a gatekeeper to determine whether or not that evidence is reliable and relevant. In this particular case, that objection was made by the defendants with respect to every single one of our witnesses on numerous occasions. The court denied those objections and allowed us to move forward with the trial. Trial lasted approximately 5 weeks. When we got to the charge conference, one of the instructions that the court included as part of the case, Your Honor, was a specific causation instruction. Essentially, what the trial court did was took a portion of the language in the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Havner and put it in the instructions of the jury charge. Let me read to you the specific language that we are complaining about. It says, in order to prove specific causation for exposure from the Somerville tie plant, the plaintiffs must exclude with reasonable certainty other plausible causes of Linda Faust's stomach cancer, such as her history of smoking cigarettes and her Helicobacter pylori infection. We refer to that as H. pylori just because it's difficult to pronounce, and that's what we refer to it as during the trial, and you'll see that in the record. When the court submitted this instruction, we objected. We objected because no court in the history of Texas jurisprudence had ever given that instruction to the jury, and rightfully so, because in Havner and in Daubert and Robinson, the courts have made it very, very clear that this is a part of the court's gatekeeper function to determine whether or not the evidence that's being presented, the scientific evidence, is reliable. So what the court did was they took a portion of Havner. Havner actually lays out five different elements, and they took a portion of that, the fifth element, and said, jury, we want you to consider this one particular provision. We believe that that actually heightened the burden of proof that the plaintiffs had in this particular case. As the court is well aware, we also had a proximate cause instruction. The proximate cause instruction includes language that says there can be more than one proximate cause. So you obviously have a contradiction here between the specific causation language in the instruction versus the language of the proximate cause portion of question number one. And let me tell you how it actually went down after that, Your Honors. The jury went out and deliberated for about 4 days or so. They sent out one instruction saying that they were hung. They then sent out another instruction saying that they were hung. But along the way, there was also a question from the jury. And if the court would look at the record, you'll see the question indicates the jury's confusion. It indicates what we had brought to the trial court's attention from the beginning. And let me read that question to you that the jury sent out. The jury said, the instruction indicates that in order to prove specific causation for exposure from the Somerville tie plant, the plaintiffs must exclude with reasonable certainty other plausible causes of Linda Faust's stomach cancer, such as her history of smoking cigarettes and her H. pylori infection. On question number two was the proportionate liability question. On question number two, it gives us the ability to give a percentage to both Linda and the railroad. The question is, if we say that smoking / infection are not causes, how can we give a percentage to Linda? ? Or vice versa, if we say that smoking / infection were partial causes, how do we give the railroad a percentage? ? The instruction seems to contradict question number two. This is part of the objection and argument that we made, that it changes our burden. when you submit this, and essentially does. It contradicts the proportionate liability question. The court then responded with the following note. The court says, your observation that a contradiction exists is well taken. You are therefore instructed that you are not to answer question 1B as to Linda Faust, nor are you to answer question number 2. The instruction given you in paragraph 3 on page 3 still applies. So what you have here, Your Honors, after closing arguments have already occurred, you have the jury raising the same or similar issues that we raised in the charge conference, that there's a problem here. The jury said there was a contradiction, and then after closing argument on, I think it was the fourth day of deliberations, the court says, you're right, there is a contradiction, there is a problem in the charge that we actually submitted to the jury. Now, the second portion, and then, Your Honors, let me add one part to that that I think is important. Within an hour of getting, about an hour of getting this note, the jury came out with a verdict. And so that leads me to believe after 4 days of very thoughtful and it appears contentious deliberation, after the court withdraws the proportionate liability question and then seems to emphasize the what we believe is an inappropriate specific causation instruction, the jury almost immediately, within an hour, comes back with a verdict. Now, if you look at the second part of that instruction, yes, Your Honor.
At the charge conference, did the plaintiffs object to the form of question number 2?
Your Honor, what we did at the charge conference was we objected to the instruction being included and submitted a proper, what we considered to be a proper form. The second thing that we did at the charge conference, Your Honor, was that we objected to, on the record, heightening the plaintiff's burden of proof. It requiring the plaintiff to do something that the law did not require it to do with respect to.
Well, both of those comments go to the instructions. I'm asking you about question number 2, the one judge eliminated.
No, Your Honor, we did not object to the proportionate liability question.
Thank you.
Our objections were limited to, one, submitting what we considered to be an appropriate instruction. That did not include the specific causation language. We objected to it actually heightening the plaintiff's burden of proof, changing the standard. And thirdly, we objected it to being addressed essentially in the proximate cause portion of question number 1. And then finally, we said it was unfairly prejudicial. And so those were the objections that we laid out. I bring the court's attention to the second portion of the instruction that we objected to. After the comma, the court says, after it gives out the specific causation language, it says or identifies the words such as her history of smoking cigarettes and her H. pylori infection. We believe that was an inappropriate comment on the weight of the evidence. So essentially you have the court saying, all right, we're going to surrender to you our gatekeeper function, and we're going to ask you to decide whether or not all plausible causes has been excluded. But the court took it one step further. The court then says, well, we think there could be a lot of causes. They use the language such as, and then they identify 2 particular causes, H. pylori and smoking. And we believe that was an inappropriate comment on the weight of evidence by the court. And so that is the second portion of the objection that we had. And, Your Honors, going back to the case law in this particular case, there is not one case out there that we are aware of, and I don't believe that the defendants or the appellee are aware of, that says it is appropriate for the court to surrender its gatekeeper function to the jury. Clearly, the language in Daubert and Havner and that line of cases make it very clear from day one when Daubert came out and Havner came out in 1997 that this is the function of the court as a gatekeeper to determine whether or not the evidence in the case is reliable and whether it's relevant. And so it really contradicts and changes the burden of proof for the plaintiffs in the case in that it heightens it and contradicts the proximate cause instruction, Your Honor. Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Were you about to ask me a question? I'm sorry. Oh, no. I apologize. I thought you were going to ask me something.
That's just the way I look when my mind's working.
So we had those are the 2 issues that we raised in the first portion of our brief. Additionally, Your Honors, I would like to bring one case to the court's attention. There's a 2002 decision from the 14th Court of Appeals. It's actually referenced in our reply. It's the Weingarten case versus the Harris County Appraisal District. And in that case, I think the court described it very appropriately, where the court said that reliability is a miscibility issue. It is not something that goes to the weight of the evidence. essentially saying, this is for the court to decide. This is not for the jury to decide when determining the weight of the evidence. And so to that extent, Your Honor, we believe that the trial court made a decision that was incorrect. We believe that the timing and the response in the terms of the jury's question clearly indicates that they were confused, clearly indicates that they believe that there was a problem. And then the court responds with its own note saying, yeah, we believe there's a contradiction. We believe that we actually got it wrong. And so, Your Honor, we believe that
Mr. Woodfield?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you walk me through one more time how you believe that your objection that the instruction given violated the court's Daubert gatekeeping function, how that objection preserved a challenge that the trial court was commenting on the weight of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
By giving the instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me go back to the actual objections themselves and the ones that we articulated in the charge conference. The first objection that we made, obviously, was submitting the instruction, what we consider to be the appropriate form, without the specific causation instruction.
You tendered your own instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. We tendered our instructions without it excluded or didn't include the specific causation instruction.
Okay.
And secondly, we then objected specifically to the instruction because we believe that by including this, the judge was actually, through the comment here, actually changing the burden of proof, changing the standard in this particular type of litigation to something that was inconsistent with, you know, almost, I guess, close to 20 years of jurisprudence in this area, beginning with the court's decision in 1993 in Robinson. Then we went on to say we believe that this is also dealt with in proximate cause, that specifically in the proximate cause language of the charge, it says there can be more than one cause. At the same time, there's instruction that's saying, no, you've got to exclude all other causes with reasonable certainty, such as smoking and H. pylori. And then the third objection that we made was that it was just unfairly prejudicial to the plaintiffs to include this language. And I'm just kind of summarizing for the court the areas that we discussed when we were talking about these particular objections. And as the court is well aware, under 33.A1A of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, one of the things that we look to is the context, is what was going on in that charge conference. This was a very hotly contested issue. When it was brought up a second time after the note came out, again, we raised the same objection that it actually heightened the standard or the burden of proof that the plaintiff had, and it did it inappropriately, did it in a manner that was inconsistent with that whole line of cases beginning with Daubert, Robinson, and then Havner. Additionally, Your Honor, I think there's a case that we actually cite. We cite in our first brief. I know it's actually in our reply brief. It's the Remington case. The Remington case specifically talks about, it's a 2002 case, I believe, where the court actually, the 14th Court of Appeals, says one of the things we need to look to is the totality of the record, that lawyers are not expected to make full appellate arguments in the charge conference. And so we believe that we clearly apprised the court of the issues and the problems that we had with the specific causation instruction, primarily that it was inconsistent with what the law is. It was inconsistent with the court's function or role as a gatekeeper of evidence to decide whether or not it actually satisfies the Havner standards. And the court only included a portion of Havner. Havner actually, I believe, lays out five different elements when you're looking at epidemiological studies. One, you know, is the chemical similar? Secondly, how does the doses compare? Are they similar? Thirdly, is there a latency period that's consistent with what's found in the study? And fourthly, you know, do they have the same or similar injuries? And the fifth element is the one that he chose to include, the fifth element that says that you have to exclude with reasonable certainty all other plausible causes, all other plausible causes. So, Your Honor, our position is that the instruction that the court gave was inconsistent with Texas law and resulted in confusion and an inappropriate verdict. The jury said on two separate occasions they were hung. At one point, I don't think I mentioned this, but it's in the record, the court did give the dynamite charge about the same time that they gave the response to the question that the jury had. That all happened really close in terms of the time frame on the same day. I believe it all happened within an hour, and then probably within an hour and a half, 2 hours of the verdict actually being rendered. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I'm proud to represent Burlington Northern, and I'm here with Debbie also from the Thompson and Knight firm, also from Kelly Hart, Mary Ann Auld, John Wilson, and Stacy Blanchett. Let me start with waiver, as we've gotten a question, Justice Walker, from you on that. First off, I think I disagree with Mr. Woodfield's view of what the charge conference was. It's very short. It's for the court to see. There are actually two times there were objections to the charge, once in response to the note as well. The real truth of the matter is neither time did he mention comment on the weight of the evidence, and neither time did he mention heightened burden of proof, and that's extremely important here. He did mention the gatekeeper function. This court's precedent is very clear on the interpretation of 274, and Rule 274, as you know, is the rule that talks about preservation of error. And the first sentence of Rule 274 says you have to do two things. First, you have to point out the part of the charge that is objectionable, the actual language itself. Second, you have to state the ground, and or grounds if it's plural. This court in Corkery versus TCU, Justice Brigham wrote the opinion, addressed that very issue. In that case, same thing happened here. What happened was there was an objection. They pointed out the offending language. And by the way, Mr. Woodfield did do that. And then they listed the grounds. But then on appeal, they raised an additional ground. In that case, comment on the weight of the evidence. And what Justice Brigham said, citing other courts of appeals cases, is that's not permissible. That's not what 274 says. Rule 274 says you have to state every ground. The Remington case that he brings up is also distinguishable. Here's what happened in Remington. In that case, the issue was a suggestion that there was a comment on the weight of the evidence. That ground was mentioned. Later in the appellant's brief, the appellant says one of the reasons there's a comment on the weight of the evidence is because of the placement in the charge. The appellee, I think foolishly, said, wait a minute, you didn't make that objection at the charge. What the court's decision is, that discussion was trying to explain the grounds that had already been made. In this case, there isn't any ground raised on comment of the weight of the evidence, nor in a heightened burden of proof. I'm going to address those from a substantive view. You know, we always hate to make waiver arguments. We hate to make them in one respect because it looks like that we're afraid of the substantive parts of the argument. So I want to turn to those, but I will tell you I do not believe either of those were waived, and I think the record is clear. The real difficulty we have here is the difference of opinion between the two parties about the Havner case, not Robinson, not the other predecessor cases, but Havner. Their position is that Havner has all to do with admissibility and nothing to do with the submission of the court's charge. It is only admissibility. Well, that's not true. Havner on its face is not an admissibility case. It was a sufficiency of the evidence case. And the court is very clear that it wasn't addressing admissibility, and it was just determining if it's unreliable, can the evidence that is determined to be unreliable under Robinson and other cases, can it turn out to be evidence that would support a jury's verdict? And the answer to that was no. And that, in doing that, the court relied on some other cases, but later, Havner has been reaffirmed in that position. The Supreme Court, Supreme Court just earlier this year in the city of San Antonio versus Pollock looked at the same issue. And the court said there was no objection to the admissibility. The court was only dealing with sufficiency of the evidence. And what they said is this. The plaintiff couldn't carry the burden of proof for a number of reasons based on the Havner decision, including not being able to explain how the accident could have, how the disease could have happened in another way, and additionally, that there was a gap in the testimony. So the evidence to carry the burden of proof of the plaintiff wasn't sufficient. If that's the case, it has a lot to do with what the burden of proof is. Here's what Havner says. And I am not suggesting that it applies in every case because it's very specific. What Havner says at page 720 is pretty clear, and there's no disagreement between the parties on this. What Havner says is, if there are other plausible causes of the injury, if there are, and in this case there were, and they were testified to by all the experts, both theirs and ours. Their dog ring, by the way, says precisely that both smoking and H. pylori are the causes of stomach cancer. And in fact, the testimony from the rest of the witnesses is H. pylori is by far the greatest cause of stomach cancer, both in the Western world and also all over the world, and smoking is a close second. So first, if there are other plausible causes of injury, the plaintiff must exclude them, and third, exclude them with reasonable certainty. That's what Havner says. Now, what they say is that shouldn't be in the charge. We think there's a recent Texas Supreme Court case that says otherwise. It is Hawley versus Rio Grande Healthcare Center, it's actually Columbia Rio Grande Healthcare versus Hawley, which is discussed at length in our brief and also in their reply brief. Let me tell you briefly about that case because I think it is on all fours with what we're talking about here in admittedly a sort of a different situation. In that case, Mrs. Hawley went to the hospital and she had colon surgery. Part of her colon was removed. It was then tested by the pathology department. They found cancer at a fairly advanced stage. What happened is, unfortunately, in disregard of the hospital policies, that notation was not sent to the treating physician. Instead, it was put in the hospital records, and he didn't see it. As a result of that, she went 7 months without any treatment. By the time it was called, horrible case. What happened was that her cancer was terminal, and although she was alive at the time of trial, everybody agreed that it was terminal. And what the court was faced with in that case is what to charge on loss of chance of survival or loss of chance of cure. In 1993, the Supreme Court, as you all know, in the Kramer case, had decided that the Texas does recognize that cause of action, but part of that cause of action is the requirement of proof that there be, at the time of the negligence, at least a 50% chance of successful treatment, or survival, depending on the facts of the case. In that case, just like here, causation was hotly contested. Understandably, in one respect, I guess, the hospital's experts said it was far less than 50 at the time, given the level 3 grade of the cancer found. Plaintiffs said, no, it was more like 60 or 65%. Same kind of disagreement we have between the experts here. The defendant asked for an instruction on the 50% rule, and the trial court refused it. But they did let them go ahead, the defendant go ahead and argue the law to the jury. Odd sort of ruling, but that's exactly what the plaintiff suggested that we do here, and that's what he's suggesting that we do in the brief. And the case goes to the Supreme Court, and here's what the Supreme Court does. They said it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to charge the jury on that issue, that the failure to do it was an absolute abuse of discretion. And the reason was it fit three things that have always been the mark of what we do. Was it raised by the evidence? It was, just like these issues were raised here. Second, was it an accurate statement of the law? Absolutely. It was taken verbatim from the case. And by the way, there's no objection that this instruction here is in any way wrong. It's just they don't claim anything about the form or the substance of it. They only complain that it was given, and that's important. Third, the Supreme Court said, would the instruction have assisted the jury? And the Supreme Court said yes, and I don't often quote when I'm up here, but I'm going to make a quote from that opinion because it's so apropos to our case. It says, it is asking too much of lay jurors, untrained in the law, to distill the correct Texas legal standard for loss of chance from the general proximate cause instruction. Look at the proximate cause instruction in this case. It is with question one. The question for this court is, could the court understand Havner's requirement to exclude other plausible causes with reasonable certainty from that definition? I think you'll have to agree, just like the Supreme Court did in Hawley, that the answer to that is no. Absolutely no. You couldn't do that. It's important. The other thing that they seemed to say and didn't argue in front of you today is there was an inconsistency between the proximate cause definition on the one hand and the specific causation instruction that was up in the general instructions. That's wrong, and it's wrong for this reason. In the proximate cause instruction in question one and in the comparative negligence instruction in question two, the issue dealt solely with negligence, somebody's fault for the accident. Perhaps smoking could be that on behalf of Mrs. Faust, but her H. pylori infection, which is a bacterial situation that in the stomach, which is one of the few bacteria that survive in the stomachs and cause this kind of disease, that wasn't her fault, and it's not submitted anyplace else in the charge, couldn't be within the issue of proximate cause because proximate cause deals with fault. So it wasn't there. Now, was it a comment on the weight of the evidence?
Let's stop a minute.
Yes, sir.
What do you think exclude with reasonable certainty means?
I think it could be a fact issue on reasonable certainty, but I think what it means is to explain away other causes that appear that may have a very plausible way to have caused the injury. In this case, Linda Faust's stomach cancer.
Well, let's suppose that the jury thought that there was a 60% chance that the problems were caused by the tire plant and 20% for the stomach cancer and 20% for cigarettes. The way I read this is that's not good enough. When you say exclude with reasonable certainty, that means to me that they need to believe that there was a 100% chance that it was caused by the exposure to the type plant.
I don't think it means 100%, and I don't think it says that. I don't think that's what the Havner Court was attempting to get at.
Well, exclude.
Well, I understand.
Reasonable certainty.
I understand your point. I point out two things. First off, there's no objection to the idea that this is a misstatement of the law. Not a one. Hasn't been made at the trial court, hadn't been made here during all of the briefing. And I don't think they could because it's a direct quote from Havner. The issue is, I think the jury was free to make a determination whether there was evidence excluding it that in reasonable certainty would have excluded the other causes. And in this case, we don't think there was. It was a disputed issue. I think the evidence from Dahlgren was purely speculative in that instance.
Well, let me ask you another question. It looks like to me that the effect of the note written by Judge Walker is to take away contributory negligence by Linda Faust and somehow put the contributory negligence burden into this instruction. Because no longer are they asked, was she negligent? And the hence, no longer are they asked, is there a percentage? So, but if she's smoking, that's contributory negligence. So how can you take away a question, an issue, and put it into an instruction?
I disagree with your interpretation of it. And the equally reasonable interpretation would be this. I mean, let's think what happened, and let's take Mr. Woodfull at his word. That the jury had been out for 4 days. We thought it was three, but it may very well be four. And they come back and they send the note. We've all sent the note. Then what happens is the judge tells them, and by the way, we did not object, so I cannot complain about the note, and we did not object to it, although we don't think the two questions were inconsistent at all, especially as to H. pylori. But in any event, here's what happens. Think about this. The jury's deliberated for 3 days, 4 days perhaps. They indicate they may be hung. They are told no longer consider Linda Faust's negligence. Don't consider that anymore.
Or at least don't answer the question.
It's out.
Is what they're told.
Yeah, but the two things that deal with negligence, the only two things that deal with negligence is question 1B, which they instruct out, question 2. Then the jury comes back within an hour and decides that the railroad is not negligent, the only negligence question left. It is a stretch to say, under those circumstances, that the effect was what they suggested is, in the question Your Honor has, that it had something to do with it was instructing on negligence. I don't think it was. That objection wasn't made at all to the trial court. And there could have been ways to have addressed that if it had been, but it wasn't made. The other issue is, look at Bed Bath & Beyond. That deals with the harm in that situation. Bed Bath & Beyond, remember, an unavoidable accident submission is made incorrectly. The defendant on appeal has to admit that is the case. Justice Green, writing for the court, says, you know, in those kinds of situations on proximate cause, when you're not indicating which way the jury should go, we're going to determine there's not harm. You don't have a Castile issue either, the court said, and the court actually, there are only two justices that disagreed with that. Otherwise, it was a split decision on a 5-4 basis.
Well, I'm sure you're not advocating that we write an opinion that approves taking away the plaintiff's negligence as to causation and as to percentage and somehow putting it in an instruction.
No, I am not. What I am suggesting, though, is in the appropriate case where other plausible causes of the injury are raised, part of the burden in a case in which you have to rely on epidemiological studies, I didn't say that right, but I never can pronounce it right, where you're relying on those kinds of things and the causation, you have to go outside what actually happened. And that's what Havner says. And you go to studies to be able to extrapolate the studies to an individual plaintiff. In those cases, you got to do three things, actually. And I disagree a little bit with Mr. Woodfull about the rest of them. One, you got to fulfill Havner of doubling the risk. Two, you have to fulfill Havner in a 95% certainty factor, as they put it, within those studies. And third, when you're dealing with those kinds of studies and extrapolating, what you have to do is also exclude other plausible causes with reasonable certainty. And it is in those situations that this issue applies. That's not all, and it's not all on general negligence cases where proximate cause and negligence would be determined from the actual facts of the case. This was done on an extrapolation basis, and that's what the Supreme Court was guarding against.
Mr. Keltner, I have a question. The direct quote from Havner, I think, is, further, if there are other plausible causes of the injury or condition that could be negated, the plaintiff must offer evidence excluding those cases with reasonable certainty.
That's right.
So how do we know which other plausible causes can be negated and which ones can't?
Well, that is another one of those things that it may very well be under Havner a factual issue for a jury. In this case, and Mr. Woodfield's quite wrong to suggest it was a comment because we mentioned two things, smoking and H. pylori. Those were the only two that were raised. And by the way, it's important in this case for you to know that's undisputed. The parties both had to agree, the experts had to agree, that both these were the top two causes of stomach cancer known. Now, in direct answer to your question,
but can they be negated?
How can they?
Can they be negated? Obviously, we haven't read the whole jury trial record at this point in time, but can they be negated? Can you prove that a certain type of cancer did not originated from this product and not from smoking or not from H. pylori?
Let me answer in two ways. And directly, the answer is, can they? The direct answer is yes. Let me explain briefly why. And let me also tell you the evidence in this case that I think did it. First off, the answer is yes, it could be. You could exclude them, and you could do it by direct evidence of what happened to this person in the ingestion of these things that might have a direct relationship to stomach cancer. The problem the plaintiffs had in this case is even Dr. Dahlgren and his studies could not relate the exposure to stomach cancer. If you look at the studies in the last 10 pages of our brief, you'll see that as he goes through them, the studies relate to some problems in some instances for workers at the plant, not like somebody, Linda Faust, who was away. And the other issue that dealt with, it didn't result in stomach cancer. Other kinds of cancers, perhaps, skin contact cancer, some instances lung cancer, but not stomach cancer. So would it be possible to do so? Yes. I think it would in the appropriate case. In this case, I don't think it was possible given the evidence that they had. Especially, and I know I'm beyond my time period and I don't want to abuse the court's discretion here, but The real truth of the matter is the other parts, one of the other things that he raises, didn't discuss in oral argument, is that the finding was against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Three things we'd say quickly that deal precisely with your question, and that is, first off, we don't think any of the experts, and it's the only experts we wanted to strike, Chairs Menonoff, I think I said that right, the Dahlgren and Rosenfeld, all of them had interesting issues. Only one of them tried to connect things to stomach cancer. Couldn't do it. The issues and the things they discussed, and we have different arguments for each one. Chairs Menonoff violates, I think, Burroughs Welcome versus Cry, because the facts he assumed don't appear to be the actual facts. The issue with Rosenfeld is his gathering techniques were a problem. The one thing, was it possible, and here's how you could prove it. If you could place where Linda Faust lived and was a huge concentration of items that caused stomach cancer, I think you could get in and do what Havner suggests that the plaintiff has to do. That was never attempted. Her house was never tested. They tested everything around, and they tested the attics of houses that had been there 100 years, and the only relevant dates were between 1980 and 1995. They tested other things where in attics where the testing, the people who come up with this testing said you ought not to test that because, first off, it's a concentration no one breathes. Never test their house. The answer to that, by the way, is never occurred to Rosenfeld to test her house. We did. We did test her house under the appropriate standards, found nothing elevated at all.
That's, thank you. That answers
I'm
my
sorry,
question.
I'm sorry. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Ms. Spisak, if you would add 3 minutes to counsel's rebuttal, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I think Mr. Keltner and I definitely agree on one thing. The key issue here is should that specific causation instruction have been given? As the Court will recall, there's not one case out there from 1997 forward where the Court, Supreme Court, or any Court of Appeals had said or has said in a toxic tort case, you take the language from Havner and you apply it to the jury charge. Hasn't happened. In fact, courts have said just the opposite. You look at the 2002 decision, the Weingarten decision that I referenced. Court has said, no, this goes to the gatekeeper function of the court. Now, he brought up the Columbia case, the Columbia versus Hawley case. What's interesting about that case, it had nothing to do with the court's gatekeeper function and whether or not evidence should or shouldn't be admitted under 702. It had absolutely nothing to do with Havner, Daubert, or any hurdles for admitting scientific evidence. What that had to do with was a specific issue that dealt with proximate cause, and that was the lost chance. He cannot tell you or identify for you one case where any court has ever said what happened in the 96th District Court was correct, that you take that specific causation instruction and you relegate that function of the trial court to the jury. Now, remember, Your Honors, he didn't give all of Havner. He gave one element of Havner, which we believe was clearly incorrect, and we believe that the objection that we made, submitting an instruction without the specific causation language, clearly preserved our error. That's what it's all about, as he said, should or shouldn't that particular type of instruction be admitted. This court would be the first court in the history of Texas jurisprudence since Havner to say that that particular instruction was appropriate in a toxic tort case. No court has gone that far and said that's appropriate. With respect to Havner, he briefly argued that it dealt with the sufficiency of the evidence. Well, the reason that language was brought up in Havner is because when determining whether or not scientific evidence satisfies that 702 standard, if the court concludes that it doesn't, then you don't have evidence of that particular issue that you're trying to prove. And so you wouldn't have sufficient evidence if it should have never been admitted in the first place. But it still all goes back to that original gatekeeping function of the trial court to determine whether or not evidence should be admitted under 702, to determine whether or not it's reliable and relevant. And as the court very well said, if we adopt this position, then there would never be a reason to have a contrib question for a plaintiff in this particular case because you just couldn't do it. You couldn't have contributory. You would essentially have sole cause on every single case because the language that they are proposing not only would prevent you from having a contributory negligence question, but it would also eliminate the portion of the proximate cause definition where it says that you can have more than one proximate cause. Using that language, you can't. Additionally, Your Honor, he talked about H. pylori. I would bring the court's attention to the record where their own expert, Dr. Peter Shields, conducted a study and found that H. pylori was not a risk factor for stomach cancer. That's from their own expert, Dr. Peter Shields. Now, what he didn't tell you is that in developing countries and other countries, there are H. pylori rates of 50, 60, 70, in some cases, 80%. At the same time, the stomach cancer rate is not even near that. Additionally, what he failed to tell you is that in Linda Faust's case, the first stain that was done to determine whether or not she had H. pylori was inconclusive. They weren't sure. She might have had it. They then did a second stain, and that second stain said, no, she doesn't have H. pylori. So that was clearly a hotly contested issue in this case, an issue in which their own expert, Dr. Peter Shields, their oncologist, had authored a paper saying that H. pylori was not a risk factor for stomach cancer. Additionally, just a few brief points, Your Honor. I would take the court back to Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 31.A.1, where you look at the entire context. I would also reference the court again to the Remington decision and the key language that we cite in Remington, which I believe was actually a 1997 decision. I may have misspoke and said a 2002 decision from the 14th Court of Appeals, was that lawyers are not expected to make full appellate arguments at the charge conference. And we believe that we preserved our error, one, primarily by submitting a question without, or instructions without, the specific causation language that has really been subject.
I think the objections have to be more specific than that. You can't just say we don't want it to be in there. I think that there's no question that the objection to the charge has got to specifically draw the trial court's attention to the error in the language. And for that, you're relying on...
Well, and Your Honor, I would say it's not as much the error in the language as the language shouldn't have been there, period. And that's what we argued to the court. We said, Your Honor, we object to you giving the jury or relegating your gatekeeper function and giving it to the jury. It's not the appropriate function of the jury. And that's really, I believe, what this case is all about. Should that particular language be given to a jury in the instructions, or is that the province of the trial court as part of its 702 gatekeeper analysis? I believe the case law makes it very clear, whether it be in Havner, whether it be in all the cases they support, cite Abraham or others, every one of those cases, the court has used that analysis as part of its gatekeeper function. Not one case do they cite for you has the court taken that language and put it in the jury instructions. They don't do that because that's not where it's supposed to be. And that's what the Havner Court and subsequent courts have made very, very clear. And, Your Honor, that's why we submitted an instruction without that language and then said to the court, Judge, we believe this is the inappropriate, this is the function of the trial court, not the function of the jury, and it shouldn't be handed to them. We made additional objections, but that is the primary gist of the argument that we're making today, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Wood.
Yes, Your Honor.
Bill,
yes, Judge,
I want to walk with you just a little.
Yes, sir.
In the trial court's utilizing of its gatekeeper function.
Yes, sir.
I see nothing in your briefing that complains that any evidence was tendered by any expert that was not allowed.
Any evidence that was tendered by any expert that was not allowed? That's correct, Your Honor. You're correct in that.
You do raise an issue about evidence, but you're talking about it being against a great weight of preponderance. But there's nothing here that's complaining that any evidence was tendered that was not allowed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then in terms of the answer to question number one, which is couched directly in language of proximate cause, with the specific definition indicating that proximate cause can be more than one cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then with the instruction in the charge that the answers to questions yes or no are to be answered from the preponderance of the evidence, meaning the greater weight and degree of credible testimony, and leaving that to the jury. There is no mention in the question of specific causation?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so your complaint is that in the structuring of the question number one, which was answered negatively against the plaintiff, that resulted from the inclusion of the specific causation instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me tell you why I believe that. Because when you go and you're doing this Habner analysis, it's not just one prong. It's not just specific causation. There's a second prong, too. The first prong, actually, it's general causation. They essentially lay out for you the standard when you're using epidemiological studies to prove causation, when you're using that form of circumstantial evidence. The first step would be general causation. Once you've satisfied that burden, you then go in to the specific causation, which includes, as a subpoint, the language that Mr. Keltner and that we complain about in our briefing and here today. And so the court only chose to take one portion of the entire standard with respect to whether or not scientific evidence should or should not be admitted, and put that one particular piece, shall we say, in the instruction.
But that's not talking about admission of evidence. All the evidence was admitted.
That's
correct. You're only talking about the weight that the jury gave to the evidence, perhaps from an application of the specific causation instruction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very much.
And the only last thing I would say about that, Your Honor, is that we believe had that not been submitted, you clearly had, as evidenced by the two notes, a jury that was hung. And it was only after, and they were hung up, as the note indicates, on that one particular issue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments here today. They've been very helpful to the court. We greatly appreciate them, and your case is submitted.